Welcome to this American Society of Hematology podcast for the hematologist, ASH News and Reports. In this episode, contributing editor Dr. Michael Scott is joined by Dr. Samita Arya. Together, they have a conversation with Dr. Cindy DeYoung. They discuss a study covered by Dr. Scott and Arya in their recent diffusion article titled Anticoagulation and Abnormal Uterine Bleeding, Acknowledging Calls to Action. Dr. DeYoung performed analysis for the study and served as one of the lead authors of the paper published in Blood. She is a PhD student at Leiden University Medical Center in the Netherlands, where she also studied medicine. Dr. Scott is a hematologist at St. Michael's Hospital Unity Health Toronto and an adjunct lecturer in the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Arya, also a hematologist, is affiliated with the University of Toronto in Ontario. All three doctors indicated no relevant conflicts of interest. Please note, ASH does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, or opinions, and disclaims any representation, warranty, or guarantee as to the same. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Dr. DeYoung, it's such a pleasure after reading your article and to be able to speak with you today. We had some questions that we were hoping to speak with you about today, but maybe to start, just because it's possible not all listeners are familiar with your article titled The Incidence and Impact of Anticoagulation-Associated Abnormal Menstrual Bleeding in Women After Venous Thromboembolism, we were wondering if you could really briefly summarize some of the key takeaway points from your article.
Yes, sure. We performed the Team VTE study. That was actually the name of the study. It was an international multicenter prospective study between August 2018 and September 2021, in which we had the primary aim to evaluate the incidence of abnormal uterine bleeding among women of reproductive age who were treated with oral anticoagulants for acute venous thromboembolism. And we actually found that the risk of abnormal uterine bleeding was high. Two out of the three women experienced abnormal uterine bleeding. And we also observed high impacts on quality of life, especially in the women who experienced new onset abnormal uterine bleeding. So the women did not have abnormal uterine bleeding before the diagnosis of venous thromboembolism, but experienced heavy menstrual bleeding after the start of anticoagulants.
Thank you so much. As you mentioned in your article, I think in the introduction, abnormal uterine bleeding affects up to 30% of women of reproductive age, but it's been relatively understudied until recently. Why do you think it's taken us so long to investigate this and appreciate its potential burden?
Yeah, I think there are different reasons for that. Indeed, it's striking that it affects so many women, but the impact of anticoagulants on heavy menstrual bleeding was relatively unstudied. The largest group of patients who use anticoagulants are patients with atrial fibrillation. And in this patient group, actually, there are hardly any women of reproductive age. So the focus has mainly been on problems that are more frequently occurring in patient categories that are more common in this population, such as the older people. And second, I think, is that after venous thromboembolism, the traditionally measured outcomes are recurrent venous thromboembolism and major bleeding. But the major bleeding definitions, the standard ones that are mostly used, they are insufficient to capture abnormal menstrual bleeding. They do not account for its chronic nature, its recurrent nature. And in addition to recurrence and bleeding, there are a lot more consequences that can be experienced by patients, which can cause a considerable impact in their lives and also affect their quality of life, their physical functioning, their psychosocial functioning. And the focus in clinical practice, but also in research, is becoming more and more patient-centered. So I think the impact on patients and the quality of life they experience is increasingly being evaluated. For women using anticoagulation, this includes the awareness for abnormal menstrual bleeding and also the burden of this heavy menstrual blood loss. And I also think that research in the area of abnormal uterine bleeding also recognized the importance of the patient experience. So measuring blood loss alone does not provide a comprehensive picture of the experience. Also, the impact is very important. And it's great that there are several questionnaires that have been developed the past years that also capture the impact, the quality of life, specifically related to menstrual bleeding. And yeah, maybe the third and last reason could be that there is kind of a taboo for some patients and clinicians who treat venous thromboembolism. So I think those different reasons all could explain why it was relatively unstudied, but it's becoming more and more studied. So attention is really growing.
Thank you so much for those insights. I wanted to pick up off of what you were mentioning about ways of capturing abnormal uterine bleeding. So the way that abnormal uterine bleeding has been discussed in the literature has really evolved. So I'm wondering if you can describe how you would assess heavy menstrual bleeding within a clinical setting, like the definition you would use and you would consider or ask other clinicians to routinely employ.
Thanks for that question. I think it's good to acknowledge that there are objective definitions such as the 80 milliliters of menstrual blood loss during menstrual period, but I think a more patient-centered definition should be used in practice, such as the one of the NICE guidelines who proposed the definition of heavy menstrual bleeding, excessive menstrual blood loss that interferes with the women's physical, social, and emotional quality of life. I think that one really captures the impact of menstrual bleeding on women's lives and also focuses on their experience of the symptom. I think that one is a good one to use. And it's also in line with the definition of bleeding as was determined in the ITRUM VTE set, which is a patient-centered set of core outcomes important to patients with venous thromboembolism. I think it's really good to capture the impact of the symptom.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for bringing up that definition, because I think it is so important that people are more aware of it, especially in work that's as patient-centered as yours is. And there were a couple of other tools that your paper used as a ongoing discussion point related to that question. So the participants utilized the ISTGBAT, the menstrual bleeding questionnaire, and then they also use the pictorial bleeding assessment chart. And we've been discussing how there's these different definitions or getting more patient-centered with the NICE guidelines. And I was curious how you chose these specific tools, as well as whether or not you encountered any challenges in their use.
Yeah, we chose the tools actually after discussion within the study team, and those tools were included in the study protocol. One of the secondary endpoints of the study, namely, was the impact of abnormal menstrual bleeding on quality of life. So therefore, the menstrual bleeding questionnaire came up, which is a validated patient-reported outcome measure and specifically measures quality of life related to menstrual bleeding. So that one was included to assess the quality of life part. And also a patient panel was involved in the design of the study. So a few patients were invited and came to the hospital, reviewed the study protocol, and also provided advice on the study outcomes that should be investigated. And they agreed also on the burden of the procedures, because we had the menstrual bleeding questionnaires and also the ISTH bleeding assessment tool. That one was included for extensive assessment of the bleeding history at baseline to provide more insight into that. And third, the pictorial blood loss assessment chart was included to assess in a more objective way the blood loss during menstrual periods. And we also used the PBAC, which is the abbreviation, to assess the amount of blood loss in the last menstrual cycle before the venous thromboembolism diagnosis, just to compare the amount of menstrual bleeding. But in addition to this pictorial blood loss assessment chart, we also wanted to capture the experience of women. So we included a self-reported definition of abnormal uterine bleeding to capture their perspective of the definition of abnormal uterine bleeding. And we did not really encounter any challenges with the use of these questionnaires, especially I think the PBAC is easy to complete. So I think that summarizes the choice for the three questionnaires in this study.
It looked like in the study you found that oral contraceptive use and hormone treatment were the most common provoking factors for patients with provoked VTE. However, estrogen-containing contraceptives were discontinued in about half of the patients who had been using them at baseline at the time of their clot. So interestingly, later on, it looked like oral contraceptives were used or their use was intensified as part of treatment and management of abnormal uterine bleeding. So we're wondering if you can comment on that a little bit and if you feel that this study guides us at all in terms of what clinicians should do in terms of oral contraceptive discontinuation, because I know this is a question that comes up a lot in treating these patients.
Yes, indeed. It's an interesting topic, the oral contraceptives, the hormonal contraceptives. And based on this study, we cannot guide decisions regarding discontinuation of oral contraceptives. But We tried to also analyze those results, but analysis was challenging because not all women had a menstrual cycle every month due to the irregular nature of the cycles. So we tried to have a look into this, and we performed a logistic regression analysis to investigate the use and continuation of estrogenic containing contraceptives and also the discontinuation, but we did not find any associations here. And also because of the observational design of the study and the low number of patients, we could not formulate strong conclusions based on these observations. But it would be interesting to study this topic. Questions are common in clinical practice about the discontinuation of oral contraceptives, but based on this study, I would say we cannot guide decisions.
That's really helpful. And thank you for outlining areas for further need of research. And I think that's so important, what can actually come out of everything that you've shown in this paper as well. This might actually potentially be an area for further research as well. So I understand if you can't answer this question, because I think you briefly addressed this in your paper. But it was really interesting that for patients who are on dabigatran, they did not experience greater menstrual bleeding after anticoagulation initiation. And I was just curious, even if you had any thoughts about why this might be, if potentially the dabigatran was chosen intentionally, or if this was unexpected, just how you reacted and how you felt about those findings.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because what you already are saying, maybe that the bigger term was chosen intentionally, that's indeed what we think may have happened. We saw that the median retrospective PBAC score, so the pictorial blood loss assessment chart score of the last menstrual cycle before the diagnosis of VTE, was higher in these women. And that could indicate pre-existing abnormal menstrual bleeding, but it's very speculative. It is remarkable that these women did not experience an increase in menstrual blood loss, but the study was not designed to answer this question and really compare the different types of DOACs. But I really agree, this is an important area for further research. And there are studies ongoing that compare different DOACs, for instance, with rivaroxaban and apixaban. So it's very interesting and very curious. And we also thought that this was not really unexpected because of the findings of a previous study. There is a study in which the treatment with the dabigatran was compared to warfarin, and they looked at the incidence of abnormal uterine bleeding, and they found that the dabigatran was associated with a lower incidence of abnormal menstrual bleeding. So not really unexpected, but we also cannot really give a reason why these women did not experience the increase in menstrual bleeding.
I agree, definitely a very important hypothesis generating finding, and one that could lead to research that is very impactful. We were also wondering what your reaction was to your finding that only about 1/3 of patients with abnormal uterine bleeding ended up receiving treatment for it of some kind, as defined in the paper. Why do you think that more women did not have treatment initiated?
Yeah, we were also a bit surprised. Now, well, maybe we were surprised, because in previous studies, it's described that higher rates of women need treatment, medical treatment or surgical treatment. We only saw a few cases of surgical treatment needed, such as hysterectomy or polypectomy. But we thought about this, why didn't more women have treatment? And the thing is that during the study, women were contacted every 2 months to evaluate presence of self-reported abnormal uterine bleeding and to evaluate the completed PBACs, the pictorial blood loss assessment charts. So for most women, they had contact with their researchers every 2 months. So the researchers were informed about heavy menstrual bleeding every 2 months. That could have been a reason why treatment related to abnormal menstrual bleeding was not initiated in all women. Also, because in the study, a decrease in menstrual blood loss was observed over time after the first menstrual cycle following the diagnosis of venous thromboembolism, we observed a gradual decrease in the amount of blood loss. So that could also be a reason, or the combination of those two, why not more women received any treatment related to abnormal menstrual bleeding. And also, we found a lower than expected prevalence of comorbidities that could explain heavy menstrual bleeding, such as myomas or polyps. And similar to that, we observed that only a few women received a treatment related to such comorbidities, such as a hysterectomy or the polypectomy. So the prevalence of explaining comorbidities was lower, which would need treatment, but also the other two reasons that I mentioned before. I think that could play a role.
That's really helpful. And I'm going a little bit off script here, Dr. DeYoung, and it wasn't a question I thought of before, but now that you're describing these things, I was also curious if you could remind us if patients were screened for any inherited bleeding disorders like von Willebrand's disease or anything else, or if that was a consideration, because you were mentioning comorbidities. So that's something that just arose to my mind as well.
Yes, it's an interesting point. We actually advise the researchers of the participating centers to perform a standardized workup of women who experience abnormal menstrual bleeding. And the workup included, or that was the advice, included a consultation by a gynecologist to investigate if there are any explaining comorbidities present, perform vaginal ultrasonography, and also perform laboratory tests, including von Willebrand's, to evaluate the presence of von Willebrand disease, and also thrombocytopenia. So those results were available for part of the women, and we did not find any women with von Willebrand disease. But it's very interesting because in the general population, it's described in quite some part of the women who experience heavy menstrual bleeding, but we didn't find any in this study.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I remember being surprised by that too. It's really interesting that wasn't something that was found when you were looking at the comorbidities. Shifting gears a little bit, and on the trend of, you know, just some really interesting findings to discuss in more detail from this paper, as you mentioned at the introduction as well, quality of life specifically decreased amongst women with new onset abnormal uterine bleeding, but not so much with those who had pre-existing abnormal uterine bleeding. And I was wondering if you could comment on some potential reasons that this finding may have arose and why pre-existing abnormal uterine bleeding may not have impacted quality of life as much.
Yeah, to comment on that, I think that if women with pre-existing abnormal uterine bleeding may already have impaired quality of life due to them heavy bleeding, there would not change much for these women. So the difference between baseline and end of follow-up measurement of quality of life would them, of course, be smaller. And we saw that this was the case for women who had pre-existing abnormal uterine bleeding. They already had higher scores of the menstrual bleeding questionnaire, and higher scores indicate a worse quality of life. So they had higher scores of that questionnaire at enrollment than the women who experienced new onset normal uterine bleeding. So therefore, the impact, if you compare the questionnaire scores at the end of follow-up and at enrollment, the impact was smaller for these patients. And I think maybe women not always realize that they have severe blood loss. That could also play a role. Sometimes they may experience their heavy periods as normal, and maybe therefore they don't see the impact on their quality of life. But it's very interesting that we didn't see a large impact in these women, but specifically in the women who experienced a new onset of normal menstrual bleeding.
Thank you so much. We think overall your study serves as a powerful call to action. We're wondering what you would advocate that hematologists, or really anyone treating patients with VTE, consider when they're treating women of reproductive age.
Yeah, that's important, of course. And I would advocate for increased awareness of abnormal uterine bleeding. It's also described in the article. But since it's such a prevalent symptom, I think that's important. And careful history taking may lead to early recognition of abnormal menstrual bleeding, and that could lead to early treatment. So I think that's very helpful. And another thing is that before prescribing anticoagulation at the diagnosis of venous thromboembolism, it's also good to mention that abnormal uterine bleeding is a potential side effect or a potential consequence. And if this would be done as part of routine care, women could also recognize it earlier. And then during treatment with anticoagulation, ask women about their menstrual blood loss and discuss whether excessive menstrual blood loss interferes with their quality of life, if they have excessive menstrual blood loss. And when you're in doubt, you could use a pictorial blood loss assessment chart to just add some knowledge on the amount of blood loss the woman is experiencing, or you could consider to involve a gynecologist. And I think also important, if a woman has abnormal menstrual bleeding, to evaluate their experiences with the bleeding and their impact on daily life, which you can do perfectly using prompts, so questionnaires to assess the impact on their daily life. And understanding the impact can help guide treatment, because you know what's important for the patient, and you can initiate targeted treatment that fits the needs of the patient. So I think those are the things I would advocate.
Thank you so much for that answer and for highlighting how something as simple as just speaking to the patient and just basic history taking with the patient in mind, as well as counseling, can be so impactful if clinicians remember to think about it, especially given the prevalence and impact of abnormal uterine bleeding that you've so beautifully highlighted. So thank you for highlighting that sometimes even these simple interventions can go such a long way. And just to wrap up, and we briefly touched on this, but we were wondering if you could please tell us a bit about what you think are priorities for future research on this topic, as well as if there's anything else that you're currently working on that you would like to tell us about.
Thank you. Yes, we already touched upon a few things. I think the contraceptives part, that's, in my opinion, something for further research or something which further research is needed. And also the differences between the different drug classes, the DOACs, and also the oral thrombin inhibitors specifically versus the factor 10A inhibitors. That's also interesting, I think. And other priorities for future research, I think, should be focused on the optimal management of abnormal uterine bleeding and, of course, strategies to prevent abnormal uterine bleeding. And what could also play a role is the prevention of venous thromboembolism. So that's a step back, actually. The prevention of venous thromboembolism in young women. So therefore, you need awareness of the risks associated with the use of contraceptives, for instance, counseling of patients. That could also contribute to prevention of thrombosis and consequently prevention of abnormal uterine bleeding that is associated to treatment with anticoagulants. So I think those are all important. Yeah, and I hope that studies, for instance, investigating the differences between the DOACs will also provide more insight into this. And that's helpful when starting or initiating anticoagulant treatment. You can discuss this with a patient and at that point already counsel the patient and tell about the risks associated with the treatment. I'm really curious to finding out the results of these studies.
Thank you so much, Dr. DeYoung. It's been such a privilege and pleasure to have been able to read your paper and to be able to speak with you about all of these questions today. So we're so grateful for your insights. And I'm sure that hematologists reading this paper, as Dr. Scott and I did, really are cheering that this is finally being talked about more openly because it's something that truly does affect patients. So thank you again for all your incredible work. It's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to discuss this important topic with you. And I'm really happy about what you thought when you read the article. I think it's an important message that really has clinical implications. And I hope that more awareness for this symptom, for abnormal bleeding in women may help them eventually. And it's a pleasure to discuss this with you. And I realized that I did not really answer the last question, Dr. Arya, about the research that we are currently working on. I could add a bit on that, but we are not currently working specifically on any of these priorities that we just discussed, but we are working on the implementation of patient-reported outcome measures. We do that in the Leiden University Medical Center at the Thrombosis Outpatient Clinic. And we have embedded a set of PROMs into the electronic health records. So it's being incorporated now in routine clinical practice. And one of the outcomes that we measure is bleeding. Of course, it's good to be aware of bleeding. And what I said before, the PROMs are based on a core set of patient-centered outcomes, which was developed for patients with venous thromboembolism. And it contains a definition of bleeding, which specifically says bleeding that is worrisome to the patient or the clinician requires medical treatment and impacts the patient. So that's, I think, a definition that will also capture abnormal uterine bleeding, which is important, of course. And I think with the incorporation of the PROMs into clinical practice and routine use of these questionnaires, when women do experience abnormal uterine bleeding, it's very, very nice to use PROMs, questionnaires, to measure the impact on those women. And this could improve patient-centered care. So I'm really happy that we are working with the PROMs here and also have awareness for menstrual bleeding.
Thank you so much for being so comprehensive and for that additional answer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast of the American Society of Hematology. For more information, visit www.hematology.org. Subscribe to this podcast via Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts.